page, and then when he finishes, we'll take a break, and then I'll keep it going up from there to how it was over the system that, that works on top. Good.
Okay.
You're on.
Yeah. Okay, so thank you very much for having me. Actually did this about 5 years ago also, I guess, I think. So we've gone through this process before. So my background, I've been here a little bit longer than Professor Ord, when I got my degree here at the University of Maryland as well. And I joined the UMIAC department as a research faculty member, working on basically the same types of things that I did my degree on my PhD. And we've, for the most part, have avoided doing character recognition for the sake of character recognition. So when you hear the word OCR, you can go out to your Best Buy or CompUSA and you see lots of different OCR packages. So doing OCR for just classifying and recognizing documents, I don't want to say it's a solved problem, but if you look at boxes, they say 99.7%. So they're doing pretty well on office-type documents. Now the challenge that we have in the type of research that we do is what else can we get from documents? Not only the characters, but what can we get from a document, or what can we get from a very noisy document, or a handwritten document? So all of these types of documents that we have, they really fall apart when it comes to using those traditional types of algorithms on. So what I want to do today is I'll go through, looks like a lot, but I'll get through quite a bit of it. I basically want to give you an idea of what document image analysis as a bigger picture from optical character recognition. Optical character recognition is what you think of it as recognizing the characters on the page, and I think that that's probably where Professor Ord will pick up in the second part. But when we from the document analysis community look at what information retrieval is or what document image retrieval is, it's a little bit of a more broad scope. So I want to take you sort of through what some of the challenges and what the difficulties are at that level, and then try to talk a little bit about what the traditional ways of indexing are, but then other things that you might be able to do with these documents without the complete conversion to a representation that you're used to, or the type of representation that you might see in a typical information retrieval type of system. So sort of a different way of thinking about how we pick out these types of things. So the reason that I didn't put the documents, the slides here online earlier is that I wanted to sort of have some leading questions, some discussion that I sort of answer later on in the slides. So if any of you would have taken the time to really go through the slides, you probably see this stuff. So, you know, there's not a lot here in the slides that you need to take notes on or anything, so I think we're pretty safe in doing that. So coming from an image processing computer vision background, the first thing I want to do is try to expand the definition of what we call a document. And to sort of get an appreciation for these types of indexing technologies, and if you were given a collection of documents, you know, what types of things would you do with them, okay, in addition to the types of things that you would be covering in this class. So, quiz, not really quiz, discussion. What is a document? If I say, you know, define a document, what would you say? How would you define it? You're in an information retrieval class, you work with documents all the time, right? So somebody has a definition of a document, right? What's your definition of a document?
I would say a collection of terms that are defined beginning and end, whether it be number of terms or recognition of what looks like an end of a document.
Okay. So that's one definition. Yeah, sure. Somebody else? How about a little bit more general or abstract? That's what you're processing documents in this class.
Ordered set of words.
Okay.
The words stored in some kind of order.
Okay. How about words? What are words? What do you find words?
What's a collection of characters?
Collection of characters. Okay. And character?
So like usually a file is not ordered and document is ordered.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else?
They add written words to the pot.
Okay.
And I mean written to include both printed and perhaps electronic text, but in some form written.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Image or multimedia material.
Okay, much more general. Good.
Combination of words and images and multimedia.
Okay. All right. One more.
I think the document should also have some tags. Tell me what party information is.
Okay, so some metadata about about what the
not
content
just
is.
Not metadata, but the format tag.
Okay. All right. Instruction.
I think it should be hierarchically structured, so it should have lines and pages and chapters, maybe.
Okay. All right. Heard one over here talking about spoken. Have you heard of spoken documents or other types of multimedia documents? I heard that term used. I think that that's important to really think of this a document in a more general sense than a collection of words and characters. Okay? And once we do that, we can start to think a little bit more about the different types of ways that we can access documents, what people might want from documents. So if we think of documents as sort of being some medium, you know, whatever that happens to be, in our case, it's language, characters, and words, an English language, perhaps, in our case, but we could do a cross language. But if we think of it more general, that this is some object that's transient across space and time, then it can take multiple copies. It could be hard copy, you can have paper, early documents in stone, you know, chiseled in stone, electronic documents. But you can also have them, auditory documents or written documents, visual documents, different types of things. And of course, we have different access requirements too for these things. We might want to search them in order to get a document that might be of interest to us. If we have a document, like a newspaper, we might want to browse it in order to find a particular topic that might be of interest. So maybe when you open your newspaper every morning, you might call that search, but you really don't know what you're looking for, right? Newspapers are laid out physically, either on the website or on a hard copy, so that we can browse and we can go through there and we can find information that might be of interest to us. That's why they put, you know, multiple front page articles on the front page, and then if you're interested, then you can go back to that page. And in general, to read. So some types of documents are set to read from beginning to end. Novels, you know, some people do go back to that last chapter first, but in general, they're intended, the authors intend them to be read. Phone books are documents, but they're set up in a certain way so that you can search for things. Okay? So when you start to think about the different ways that documents are set up and the different things that a publisher or an author put into these documents in order to create them, it's not just a collection of words anymore. It's the layout on the page. It's all the information there. They put certain words in bold, certain words in italics. Okay? Typically, in the information retrieval community, those types of things aren't necessarily used, okay? But if you're coming from a hard page, a rendered page, or actually any of these types of things, but we'll talk pretty much today about hard copy documents, all of that information is important because, in theory, we can use it. Now, have people used it? Yes, but I would say on a limited basis. But all of that types of information is useful for us to be able to do retrieval on these types of large collections that I'll talk about. So just keep that in mind, okay? And of course, sources of documents, the web, digital copiers, you know, digitization projects. Typically, what we think of is we think of a scanner next to your PC. But there's a lot of different places that we get documents from, and these images that we can get from these document images, whether they're scanned or we take a picture with a camera, any of those types of things, is changing quite a bit. And one of the issues that we have doing research is we don't get these clean documents that just came out of your laser printer from Microsoft Word. Okay, and the types of things that we have to deal with are the much tougher problems, handwritten material, material that has, you know, facts, so it's very low resolution. Those types of things. Okay. So, this is sort of summarizing what we just talked about. So, the modality is what we're expressing, the means of expression. The linguistic part is what we've pretty much talked about so far, and that's the traditional definition of a document. Electronic text, printed, handwritten, spoken, signed, whatever type of thing is the base for whatever language you happen to use. So, can use a traditional written language. If you're a 7 or 8 year old, you can come up with your own language and claim that you can talk to your friends. If you're a cryptologist, you can come up with a way to encrypt or a new language completely to use that. Non-linguistic modalities, music, these are ways of conveying information to someone else or some other thing. And then what we see at the end, you know, the media that we use, the way that we get this information across time and across space, endless numbers of ways of doing that. But again, we'll talk pretty much about hard copy paper documents today. All right. A little bit harder now. What's an image? I hear from some of the other people that I didn't hear from. Anybody over here? Know what an image is? Everybody knows what an image is.
Picture.
A
visual representation.
Okay, a visual representation. Okay. We'll come back to that word representation. Something else? Anybody else?
Well, I'm getting narrower here, but I think for our purposes, it's like, you know, bitmap representation, something that's electronic image.
Okay, good, good. So the representation that you're talking about is exactly that. An image is a way of conveying information by differences in intensity, differences in color arranged on the page. Okay, so if we think of that, cameras, scanners, whatever it happens to be, are taking that, and it works very much in the same way as your eye does, and basically you're measuring in very small areas, you're measuring the light intensity and projecting it on a 2D plane. Okay, so if we think of this as an image. When we scan an image into the computer, this is all we get. We get a set of numbers representing the value. Now, it's a little more complicated than this. If we have, you might see a RGB type representation. So you see different numbers of bytes for color. You've got red, green, and blue planes for this, for an image. But in general, if you take these types of an image representation, to start off, there's no words here. There's no characters here. All it is gray values or color values associated with each pixel. So if you look really carefully here, you can see on the board, there's a whole bunch of dots here. And that's basically what it is. If we zoom in very, very close on this, all these are is individual color values here representing basically an intensity map. There's no content there. There's no word dogs or cats or whatever types of words that you want to index on. So the question is then now, how do we deal with these types of things when we do retrieval? Well, one way might be able to try to do retrieval right on here, but in general, for documents, we know that the language that we're trying to express in the document is much more general, much more expressive, and so what we're trying to do is take one of these types of things and move from this collection of pixels, collection of dots, that we see here, okay, to a representation that we're more comfortable with. Okay, we're more comfortable with speaking a spoken language or representing words and characters and sentences and linguistic constructs. Okay, so assuming that we start off here, exactly what you said before, a bitmap. Typically, a document is black and white. We refer to that sort of as a pseudo-binary document because if you actually scan the document, you get different shades of gray level, but for the most part, most documents, at least the text components, are intended to be black and white. Very high resolution, okay? Imagine 300 dots per inch. If you good at math, an 8.5 by 11 times 300 dots per inch, you compare that to what you have in your camera, you can easily get single documents that are, you know, 8, 9, 10 megabytes with just basic color information. Okay? Typically you'll find these stored as TIFF or PDF images. A lot of times they don't look that large when they're in files because there's black and white documents tend to compress very well. But compared to the analysis that we do on individual images, like for example in a video camera, people that work on regular image analysis, surveillance video, we're probably, in some cases, in order of magnitude, more data that we have to deal with simply because of the large size of these documents. Okay, but like you said, we probably want to be able to process them like text files. All right. So what's a document image database? So these, I'm just kind of trying to go through a few terms that we'll think about, because for the most part, even within the document analysis community, people don't think of databases of images. They think of collections of images where the goal is to try to convert them. All right. But if we want to be able to take these images and be able to do all of the same types of things, abstracting and routing and editing and dissemination interpretation, we have to come up with these collections of documents. And the research that we're focused on is primarily dealing with very large heterogeneous collections. So it's not the type of document processing where the IRS has a system to process all its tax forms, because all the tax forms look very similar. You can do a dedicated system for that. It's not the kind of thing where you have postal service even that's trying to recognize points of delivery, because we know every single point of delivery in the United States, in fact, most of them in the world. So it's a very constrained problem. Or the banks that are trying to recognize amounts on checks, only a finite number of numbers that we can have and the words that you can spell out. And of course, there's some variation on those types of things. But the types of problems that we're dealing with and the types of problems that I think that are interesting as feeding into information retrieval systems are the kinds of collections of documents that are just absolutely anything, newspapers, maps, and you might not know what those types of documents are to begin with. So here's just some examples of the types of things. I just grabbed some things from the database that we have. So you can see up there in the upper corner, we have some documents that have handwritten annotations. We have some things that have table-like structures. The third one over there is very noisy documents. Dictionaries, phone books, newspapers. Here's one that's a journal article that you can see and that somebody photocopied, so you have a lot of noise around the edges. And again, there's no characters on this page. You as a human are interpreting the pixels here and saying that those are characters. But there's no ASCII value, there's no Unicode value in the file that says IN space. None of those things exist at this point. Same way with these types of things, just invoices. These are the different types of documents that we have to deal with. Okay? These are documents too. You're doing analysis of the web. One of the big things in the early processing of the web is everybody put images up for the types of things that they were interested in, even the titles, you know, to make them look fancy. They didn't have the alt tag in their web pages. All of these types of things are things that you might want to do index and retrieval on. Imagine if you had a system, some of your boss comes to you and say, well, I want to get all the catalogs that I can find, download them from Google, wherever, and I want to be able to do indexing and retrieval on catalogs. Then I have to be able to recognize the fancy scripts, different colors, different sizes on the same page, I have to be able to find the characters, all of those sorts of things. So, in that sense, even when we narrow the definition of a document to something hard copy printed on a page or something that we want to have characters that are going to convey some type of information, there's still a lot of variation in the type of things that we're going to use here. Okay, here's some more. In this case, Hindi document, some different text in both Latin characters, graphics. Okay, here's some Chinese, and there's some mixed English and Korean document here. So all of these types of things, with all of this noise and stuff, that's the type of thing that we have to deal with. All right, so how can we deal with this? How can we index and retrieve this collection? So somebody come, anybody have a book, just a regular book? Okay, so hold that up. Do you have a book? How would you index and retrieval on that?
We only have one book, it's easy.
How you doing?
That's the book.
That's the book. You want to do passage retrieval on that. Okay, OCR, right? That's a nice, I'm sure you, without even looking at that, you know that has a reasonable thing. It's, nobody wrote it by hand. It's machine printed. good shape, we should be able to do something with OCR of that, right? Okay, all right. How about your notebook there? Hold up your notebook there. Okay? How would we deal with that? How many people want to bet that I don't think you can go down to CompUSA and find a OCR system that's going to, not that your handwriting's bad, that won't recognize that? Okay?
Not CompUSA, but there is off-the-shelf, expensive off-the-shelf software that does it. Is there not?
No, I wouldn't say that you'd be very happy with the OCR that comes out of handwritten material.
I can't even recognize my OCR.
There you go. Okay. I'll do a little side here and say exactly that. If you take numbers that people write or letters, individual letters, from clean printed material, so you're asked to print things, print a page of text, and you present back to other people that are familiar with the language those individual characters. Anyone take a guess at what recognition rates are quoted on average? Individual characters now, not words. Close, yeah. 75 to 80%, okay? Meaning one out of every four characters, even a human can't get. You know, this is, of course, you know, not kind of writing that you're going to see on a wedding invitation or something like that, but normal handwritten material. Okay? What if I gave you a document that had lots of graphs in here? How are we going to do a retrieval on that? I mean, you're a scientist and somebody wants to be able to do gene sequencing and pull back certain protein sequences and things like that. What are you going to be able to do with that? You have to write a new retrieval system for every time you do that, or a new OCR system for all those? How about if I'm dealing with schematic diagrams? Hundreds of, you know, here at the university, every time they run a new wire, a new line underneath the ground, somewhere that gets put down in a document somewhere, in a schematic, or a new building gets built, okay? All of these types of things are really difficult. Now, what we're going to claim tonight is that there's a small piece of document image retrieval that's sort of a combination of information retrieval and document understanding. Now, the lab that I work in is called the Laboratory for Language and Media Processing. And one of the big problems, and I'm not sure that we've even taken a bite out of this problem, is how do we go from the image to the language component in order to do not only indexing and retrieval, not only IR, but natural language processing or other types of applications. What do we know about document analysis problem, and what can we learn from the language people, the linguists, that will help us do the document analysis program, and what can we tell instead of just, you know, doing OCR and handing off all of these documents, you know, just the text part, what can we give the linguists in order to be able to do their automated processing a little bit better. So let me just take a little bit of time and say what the traditional view is of doing these types of things, and then what some maybe non-traditional views are of being able to do these types of applications. So I think you probably have some idea here that we have document or document image or hard copy document. The one we can hold in our hand, it's all written on a piece of paper, typed on a piece of paper. We put it through a scanner and we get the page image. 300 dots per inch, big file, stored as TIFF image, whatever. Think of it as a bunch of pixels. Then we do some document image analysis, some page decomposition. We're going to split that up. And we're going to look at the structure. We're going to look at where blocks are on the page. And we're going to look where, you know, classify things. This is a figure and this is an image. I'm not going to talk too much about exactly how you do those types of things. But we might get the structure of the document out. And then we're going to find the text regions. And actually, you know, with this structure, it's not just the text regions we're interested in. We can take the images, and we can take the figures and pass them off to some other system. But the optical character recognition works on the text regions. Okay? And we're going to get some characters, or we're going to get some things that we call shape codes, some representation of these characters. All right? This is typically done by grouping these characters on the page, And then using some pattern recognition techniques to try to classify each of the individual characters. Now, of course, we want to try to, we have some constraints, right, when we do this, when we know what the different characters typically look like, if we know the language, and we know different words if we know the language or what the script is in. Maybe if we know the font, we know even more about what the characters look like. So there's a lot of information that we can go that can go into here, but it's still a pretty challenging problem that we want to do. So I want to take a little bit of a step back and look at what we might want to do with these collections of document images. Alright? So first of all, you know, we want to be able to work on something that we're really comfortable with. So we need to be able to access that content, okay? So the content-based image retrieval, actually looking at words, keywords, the natural language, that's probably the thing that we're most comfortable with, right? But in the area that I work in, query by structure, so I might want to say, okay, well, I have this huge collection of documents. Give me the ones that are letters or memos, or give me the documents that are financial forms or forms or some other type. So I might want to add these types of things. So document structure is something that's of interest. We might also want to query by these functional attributes that I was telling you about before. Okay, so the author or the publisher puts these types of things. So the first thing is the very first part, the first page in nice big bold letters, because the title is supposed to give you some information. Okay, so the whole process of taking these documents and being able to come back with some information, some metadata that lets us do queries in these ways is what's ultimately important. Okay. The document image now, but I'm gonna skip this and move right to this. So this is what was taken from a recent project that we had. So suppose from two slides back, you know, we had the image that came in. This sort of expanded view of what we might want to, what we have to do with these documents. Well, the first thing is, do we even know what's a document? All right. Imagine the problem of email attachments. Okay. Got all these things coming in, and people are sending you documents, they're sending you Word documents, they're sending you images, scanned images of documents, they're sending you pictures of their grandchildren and all sorts of things. Okay? So the first problem that we have over there is classifying these into images, document images, images without text, and images with text. Okay? So that's one of the fundamental problems that we have. Second thing is in some type of enhancement. Enhancement, there's a lot of different ways to look at that, and I think I actually have a different slide there. But you can have the kinds of noise that we saw on the sides of those pages. We can have scanner noise, meaning text from the intensity of the image that's overlaid. Skew is considered noise. If I have a page here and go through the scanner like this, okay, my lines aren't parallel anymore, so I don't have that. That's a noise. I put it through a fax machine, it comes up upside down. Those are types of things that we need to do some type of enhancement here, because all of these other types of applications that we have, whether it's decomposing the page into different pieces that we can pass on to different algorithms, whatever happens there, I guarantee you every one of these different applications is making some assumptions about the document. So think about that the next time you go and buy an OCR system. The assumptions that they're making are a very clean, very nice, high-resolution, laser-printed page. Yeah, maybe you can get 99.7% accuracy there. The problem that you're going to run into if you're designing real information retrieval systems, though, is you aren't going to be anywhere near that if you are trying to deal with data in the real world. So then there's just some other things you can look at those later. Another fundamental choice here is distinguishing between hand machine print and graphics. Hand print, like I said, have completely different types of algorithms that you're going to use. Machine print. Then once you have hand print, you have to detect the line. Signatures are hand print, but they're not something that you typically recognize. I don't know anybody that probably could recognize anybody else's signature as a set of characters. In fact, maybe you're not supposed to. But signatures are usually process separately, because from an image processing point of view, people tend to write signatures that are similar, and we should be able to match them. So we use the more traditional image processing techniques. Down here at the bottom is how much time we have to be able to process these. Okay? This is a very, very liberal set of time constraints. Half a second to be able to tell what kind of document it is, 2 to 3 seconds to be able to do the enhancement, another couple seconds to do the classification, maybe the OCR piece isn't even in here. Okay? And that usually takes 5 to 10 seconds a page. So if you imagine you're an organization where you're doing, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents a day, I think the types of collections that Professor Ward's going to talk to you about in the information retrieval community, hey, you know, if I don't have 25,000, 100,000 documents, it's not even worth doing experiments on. You can easily figure, you know, if you take 10 seconds even a page, how long 100,000 images are going to take to be able to process. That's a big difference there that we see. All right. So, I think I've already answered this one. But why is document analysis difficult? Different styles, different layouts, noise, different languages, different scripts within the same language. Okay? All of those sorts of things make these types of problems very difficult. All right? So, one of the things that we can think about now is, well, if I'm going to try to get it all and sort of pigeonhole everything into a document analysis representation, a set of words and a set of characters, we've already shown that's pretty difficult. But if we sort of relax that constraint and say, wow, well, you know, maybe there's some other types of things that we can do to make indexing and retrieval possible, and we don't really have to go and do all of that type of stuff. That is the kinds of things that start to make the problems interesting. One of the challenges is, unfortunately, that a lot of the techniques that are being developed don't scale real well. So when you want to start using them on hundreds of thousands of documents or very diverse collections, there's some work that I'll talk about a little bit later on word spotting, finding words that look similar. It's been applied to the George Washington manuscripts. Well, you know, the word government looks the same in all the George Washington manuscripts. We can use some image processing to match those types of words and do retrieval on that. Well, you take somebody in the 21st century who doesn't write as neat and stylistic and doesn't have the same words looking the same, it's going to be much more difficult to do those types of things. So, let's take a couple of the more interesting stages, parts of the problem. One of the areas that has gotten a lot of research, and it was sort of on the left-hand side of that flow chart, is page segmentation, or what we call layer segmentation. This comes from the view of not just taking a document that looks like this and saying, okay, you know, put a box around here, put a box around this, put a box around this, because they're spatially located together, but it's more of a generative model, saying, okay, well, you know, we started off with a page. Okay, it had some background, had some stuff on there. All right, and then we added some machine-readable text to it. Okay, and maybe it wasn't just machine-readable text, but it had a logo on it to begin with. All right, so fundamentally, these are all different pieces of the document. Then we have a table, and that's different content, so we better treat that a little bit different. Then when we put it through the scanner, we got the noise here, and we had some autographs and figures. And then somebody got this memo, and they had it sitting on their desk, and they made some handwritten annotations on it. Okay. So if we think of it like this, we can think of the problem of segmenting these types of things into their constituent parts. Now, do we, in the research community, again, what's going to happen if we can do this? If we can solve this problem, okay, what do you think? What do you think about OCR? Okay? If I don't have to run OCR on this, and I don't have to run OCR on this, or this, or this, or this, maybe I can only run OCR on this, or run it on this, what do you think? Think we stand a chance? Probably. You don't have a very good resolution document there. But the types of things that we can do, let me just jump down here, taking these types of things, taking these pages apart, okay, taking and identifying the signatures, identifying the handwritten material, okay, and passing them through some document analysis part, that you start off with something like this, where I run my page segmentation without knowing anything about what any of the content is, okay? And it thinks that this is text, and it thinks that this is one big block of text here, and this is text, without knowing anything. If I take that and I divide that page up, and I just print, put that machine print part through the same page segmentation algorithm, I get nice blocks that does very well, okay? And I guarantee you, if I put this same page here, I just wanted to show you that you get a reasonable resolution through, I'm going to get much better results. Because what happens is, these OCR systems, these document analysis systems, they try to take the page and they try to learn from it. They try to see, okay, you know, they try to estimate heights of lines, and they try to estimate heights of characters. They try to recognize the language, all of those sorts of things. And if you're trying to recognize line heights and character heights and stuff like this, or this type of noise here, or even this type of hand print, in this case, signature, you're in real trouble. But if you have something that's consistent, okay, and you can start off with the algorithm in the basic flavor here, you can do very well. All right? So just going back here, I talked a little bit about view correction, image text region correction, classification, you know, what is the title, what is the signature block, what are the two-part text region classification. I talked a little bit about that. Here's just some results showing, you know, the difficulty of being able to take these types of images. You can't just throw a box around them in many cases, and the text region detection, and that's what I just showed you. So in this case, it's some of the system that we have for doing this page layer segmentation. All right. Language identification, we hit on that just a little bit. You know, being able to do this type of thing, deal with the text that's in vertical, you know, if it's in some Eastern languages, recognizing the script that it's in, being able to do these types of things, not only at the page level, because statistically, it's fairly easy to use patterns on the page to determine, you know, Arabic from one of the Western languages, for example. But if you have a bilingual dictionary or something else where you have to tell these things at the word level, you're talking 60-70% accuracy that you get, you know, with the traditional methods, and even humans have difficulty doing it sometimes. But those are the types of things that we've really been focusing on. Okay. Let's focus a little bit on handwriting, on optical character recognition. So, optical character recognition is a sort of an offshoot or a traditional application of pattern recognition. My advisor that was here at the university was sort of one of the fathers of pattern recognition. He was here in the field when I first got started. And he wrote a survey with me actually on my last year before I graduated. He went back, he remembered all of the big meetings, and he had handwritten notes, and he actually pulled out places where they said, okay, we're starting this computer vision, this pattern recognition community here. Why don't we find an easy problem to work on? And that easy problem was character recognition. Why? Well, there's only 26 characters plus upper and lower case and some numbers and a little bit of punctuation. It's black and white. We don't have to worry about all that other stuff, you know, that we typically take with a camera. Put it on a scanner, so everything's in a plane. We don't have to worry about perspective. We don't have to really worry about lighting, because the lighting is pretty good for scanners. 5 years, we'll have this problem solved. We'll move on to something else. Well, 5 years later, same problem comes up. I made progress. You know, we classified, a single font, for example, of images that were created, you know, perfect CRT type images. But, you know, still a big problem. Maybe, you know, 10 more years. this goes on and on and on. And although we've made a lot of progress, I can guarantee that I can show you 10 times as many problems as there were 10 years ago that are interesting now, right? So handwriting is still one of the holy grail. Script-based languages, Arabic, Burmese, Hindi, these connected languages, being able to recognize those, especially in hand print. So there's a lot of different techniques that go through these types of applications and are able to make progress towards these. But we're coming up with harder and harder problems. So it's really not a solved field. There's lots of interesting problems. How many of you have a camera on your cell phone? How many of you have ever been at a conference or somewhere where you wanted a magazine store or something where you wanted to take a picture of a document with your phone and send it somewhere else? Or just remember, just use it to take a note. Anybody? Yeah? Okay. These are the kinds of problems now. We're making this even more difficult by introducing these new types of problems. Okay? I'd love to be able to use this as a backup machine. I'd like to be able to take this and type in a number and send it off as a fax. Well, the truth of the matter is there's a lot of processing that needs to be done. And though we're making a lot of progress in the character recognition problem, and if we solve it, we solve it. Like the computer vision problem. The general computer vision problem is recover the world. That means every single point you see in an image, tell me where in 3D space that is and what the angle is and what exactly what color it is. If we can do that, great. We can solve all the other problems. Same way here. If we can take and interpret every pixel, character recognition, you guys are going to get a lot out of that. If we can interpret every pixel and say every pixel, exactly which component it's, or which object on the page or what piece of content that it's involved with, you know, we're going to solve a lot of problems. But we're a long way from that for the general problem. All right, so document image retrieval. Does it solve a problem if we can do document conversion, if we can convert text to, convert images to text?
Partially.
Partially, it goes a long way, right? Okay?
If you believe in the bag of words, you're there.
Yeah, all right, if you believe in the bag of words, press the word set. What else? What else about a document image have you seen, or book in front of you, or articles that you've seen that you just haven't dealt with here in this class? What other kinds of metadata, what other kinds of information? You were saying before about style information, right? We talked a little bit about that. What else? What else could we want to use out of a document image?
I'm thinking, what about moving images?
That's a problem that's being worked on. Yeah, text that, you know, both ticker type information and movie type credits, the scrolling type text. But just the hard copy documents that you have. What else? If you were, you wanted to go and you wanted to get, you know, impress your boss because you're going to do a new information retrieval system, okay, and it's going to work on hard copy documents and none of the stuff everybody knows, the stuff that was done in Professor Ward's class is just, you know, old stuff. What's the new stuff that you could use? What type of information is on a document that you might want to use?
I had one quick point to add. If it's the location on the document that something appears, so if you were to turn a document into a bag of words and the document was the verdict of a court case, the bag of words said guilty, not guilty, and somewhere on this paper a checkbox appeared.
Okay,
so
good.
I don't know if it's going to
good.
Be checked on guilty or checked on not guilty.
Okay.
Unless you know where on the document.
Exactly. So you have to have some structure of the document. Page numbers. You see a number 5. You know it's a page number or I mean, it's a word, right? I mean, it's in your bag of words. But is it page number 5? Or is it 5 and a date?
Continued on page B24.
Okay. Newspapers. You have the structure. You throw that in there and you want to try to you find an article. You're kind of out of luck. Okay. How about some of the examples that I said before about, you know, finding financial documents, things like that. That's sort of high level structure. But what else?
Well, I mean, some documents have legal debts and
summons
or, you know,
okay.
Like that, or
so if you're looking for a particular type of document.
Yeah. your intentionality and context? I mean, that's
okay.
Yeah.
All right. How about some other official documents?
Yeah, you have a logo on that
one. Logo? Okay. Stamps on there, classified, unclassified, dates that they might have been received, things like that. How about more in the structure of a document? How about in a letter, business letter?
From
and to, right? If you have an address block at the top and the bottom, just treat it as a bag of words. If you don't have that metadata, you don't have any of that stuff.
I was thinking, I don't care about what it says in the document, I care about the handwritten annotation that says, okay, let's do it, Cheney.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Right. A transcript. If you had a print transcript of a conversation, Professor Ward was working on the space Apollo mission transcripts. You know, one person says one thing, another person says another thing. What order they come in? Okay. Trying to understand the flow of a conversation, those types of things. Okay, all those things are important. Okay, so the claim here is that even if we do convert the stuff, and even if we do the structure, there's still a lot of types of questions we might want to ask. We haven't even talked about things like graph. Give me information that shows the trend of population growth, or you know the global warming shows the trends of carbon dioxide from 1972 to 2007. Okay, those types of things. All of those types of things are things that without some detailed document analysis, tables, all the information, there's implicit structure in tables, right? I mean, the columns mean something, the rows mean something. Unless you do those types of things, those are all sort of mini retrieval problems that you can consider. And conversion is very difficult for those things. So the question is, can we take those things and deal a little bit better with the types of retrieval we do? So let's say, but still, let's narrow it down some more. Let's still stick with the optical character recognition problem, okay? Well, we do it pretty well, but we have some problems, okay? The biggest problem in character recognition actually isn't the problem in machine printed anyway. Isn't the problem of recognizing individual characters. So I quoted some, 70-some percent of being able to recognize isolated digits or isolated characters. That's not really so much of a problem in machine print. So if I have even low-quality images in machine print, if I have them segmented correctly, individual boxes around there, I can do a pretty good job. Okay, sometimes I might get, some characters mixed up with each other. O's and 8's, for example, sometimes, you have an O and you have a line through it. Depending on how you process that, you might get confused. But the accuracy problem, even without that, is still difficult. You have segmentation problems, okay? If you take two characters, an R and an N, and recognize them together, that looks pretty much like an M. So if you squint right there, you're not going to be able to tell the difference between that. And squinting is essentially being able to say that you're doing a low-resolution view of this. Confusion of characters, like I said, some of those types of things, the problems of being able to actually process the individual characters, some of them uncommon fonts, all right? There was a project that we had that the sponsor wanted us to be able to recognize any type of fonts that they came with. And they came with one of the things in a test case was a bunch of cheerleaders doing, different stances and forming out different types of characters. They had a whole bunch of documents that in order to keep it from being recognized, the people printed them out in these types of fonts. They had football players and they had everything. As part of this package, and they just randomly printed them out. And they said, we don't want to be able to do that. So there's those types of problems already. Well, there's some things that we can do to help improve those types of things. Commercial applications have pretty much dealt with the optical character recognition problem as a brute force problem. So ScanSoft or OmniPage, those types of things. They have tremendous amounts of training data that they have. They just try to get every single font, and they train neural network-based approaches. They just have very, very, very large statistical types of things. For some places, voting works very well in being able to do this, because the theory is that the OCR engines are based on different techniques, different types of training data to be able to put those types of things together. But perhaps the most important piece that's really been underdeveloped in our community is the use of linguistic information, okay? Language models, you know, what characters follow what characters. If I have a Q and an X together, then I know that it's either some strange symbol or it's not really a word, okay? Just based on those types of things. And linguistic models can be very, very powerful. Like I said, in the applications of postal service applications, there's only so many street addresses. There's a lot of different ways to spell street, ST, SDR, period, street. You can even spell it wrong, or you know, you might use a different language. But for the most part, those types of words are there. So the linguistic aspect is a way to really do that. Okay, I talked a little bit about the reading order we talked about. Somebody actually said, you know, continued on page 8. It was really supposed to be continued on page 4, but you get the idea. So these types of structural clues are very important for putting these types of documents back together. So we talked a little bit about that. Okay, so what about information retrieval on OCR? Well, as Professor Ward hinted at the beginning of class, it really requires some different ways of thinking. So I'm not going to go too much into that, because I know that he's going to talk a little bit about the two different types of applications here. But really, when you look at document analysis, statistical methods are what's used. So a lot of times we don't make repetitive errors. We don't make the same errors over and over again in the exact same way. So if you recognize the word dormant somewhere in the document, maybe you recognize it 2 or 3 times, and you miss it 8 other times, statistically you can still get access to that data, or using these types of things. So really, the progression has been, and these are quoted in many, many places, you can do really well with high quality OCR. So if we have good 99% accuracy, 98%, we can do really well. You can use your standard systems, all the systems that you're going to build in this class. But you have really limited success for poor quality or lower quality OCR. And there's been some work that says, you know, we can take the OCR and we can do some processing on it, do some clustering. And in this case, you know, we can get down to the 90% area, and maybe, you know, we can get down to 85% by doing some other processing. But we still can't answer all of those other different types of problems that you can with logos and other things. Okay, I'm going to skip a little bit of this. But one thing I did want to say is a technique that was developed that's gotten a lot of advantage, or a lot of press, I would say, is working with n-grams. Now, what n-grams are is a statistical way of looking at the same types of documents. So the reason that IR community likes n-grams is because we have words. We still have words. Now, the words are much shorter now, okay? They're only 3-letter words, okay? But if I take a word, like a document, and I split it up into 3-letter words, well, if this U is recognized as an X, then I'm still only affecting half of those types of words, right? Of those little mini words, okay? So all the traditional things that you use work. We might have to lower some thresholds. We might have to deal with, you know, the robustness issues in a slightly different way. But if we use n-grams, it's shown that we can get down to 75-80% accuracy in the OCR and still, for the most part, be able to retrieve the types of things that we're interested in retrieving. Big reason for that is there's language models that the language that's behind the documents that we're trying to convert are very powerful. Okay? These types of words appear in certain places in these words in our language. It's very powerful to be able to extract that. And what that shows is that the language is down at the subword level. So you know, we get the whole word, but it's definitely not unique. But statistically, over a large collection, we we're able to deal with those types of things. Okay? So this is sort of a summary. 80% above, we could use some type of processing with linguistic correction. Between 75 and 80% with use n-gram statistical part. Below 75%, there are some techniques that are used, but they're no longer a conversion. So we're not worried, we're not trying to, for example, be able to recognize individual characters. And I don't think I didn't put in anything about the shape coding. The basic idea of shape coding is I want to use the same idea. Okay, I want to say that this is a character that doesn't have any holes and it falls between the X line and the baseline. This is an ascender character. This is a descender character with a hole. This is an X line character with a hole. So those types of things, even if it's really, really bad, chances are I can still say things at that level of description. So it's almost like a new language for describing these characters. Okay, it's really robust to all the noise types of things. And the language, the underlying language, still allows you to do retrieval because permission retrieval people, they want words and they want characters. So I'm giving them a vocabulary, a little bit different, much more limited vocabulary, but I can still do those types of applications.
You actually do have shape coding on this slide 46.
Oh, do I? Coming up? Must have moved it around. Okay. Okay, I'll get to it. All right. I'm gonna skip a couple of these. Okay, so one of the areas that has received a lot of attention more recently is this idea of keyword spotting. So the idea of keyword spotting is we want to do some type of analysis in the image domain. Okay? You don't necessarily want to do conversion and then try to use our traditional information retrieval technique, but rather we want to use the word shape or some pieces, some information about the strokes. We want to convert these words to a set of features like the shape coding that I was just talking about, and to be able to take those types of things and to be able to spot words. So I can essentially take a query that I have, okay, and I know what the text looks like, so I can convert my query into these shape features, and I can take the documents and convert them into the shape features, and like I said, I can do pretty well at recognizing those shapes. And then I can do all these types of things. I can do filing systems, and I can do IR applications, maybe even process handwritten documents. If I can detect loops, some things that probably won't change a whole lot. And so I'm just essentially shifting the feature set that I'm dealing with. And so there have been some very good work on doing that. The big problem is that they don't always scale very well. Here's just an illustration of the shape coding that I was talking about, I guess. So this is what happens here is if you can detect the baseline, the top line, and the X line, which is fairly easy in machine printed documents, even if you have text that's very combined together here, we just replace the things that are ascenders by capital A, an ascender goes above there, things with holes in it by, I believe, an A here, and then something that has a downward concavity, which we can typically tell. And basically, we get this new language, and then we simply map those characters and use traditional IR techniques in there. Holes, punctuation, there's been a lot of different work about different types of things. And of course, it depends on how robust the different pieces are. So these are just some of the shape codes. All right. Some of the other applications that have sort of been on the verge, and NASA work that I talked about was the archival manuscript system, the ones that he was doing shape code, our word retrieval on the George Washington handwritten manuscript. It was recently a large number of work. The EU had a big project from 2002 to 2005 working on historical documents. A lot of work on document image compression, those types of applications. Okay. All right. So just to summarize here, I've just got a couple more slides. What I hope that you got from this, in addition to what you're going to see in the next section, is that there are a lot of questions that you can ask that we can start to think about image-based indexing. Some features they might be a little less discriminatory than the actual text, the actual content. But, you know, if you take deeper courses than this, you're going to learn that even the words that you have written on the page mean something different depending on what other words are on the page. So information retrieval, you try to get documents that might be relevant. So really understanding the language, that's completely on the other side. A lot of features that we try to use are easier to compute than necessarily things that would have to be to discriminate between these 26 letters and numbers and punctuation. We try to have things that are much more robust to noise and try to make these things computationally efficient because we have a lot of stuff that we're trying to do. If we can do those types of things, we can not only ask more questions, but there's a lot of applications of traditional IR technique that we can do. Hopefully you saw that the structure is important. Not that there are a lot of OCR, or, I mean, information retrieval systems or retrieval systems in general out there that use the structure, but there are different types of ways of indexing. And this structure is really important for really understanding the depth. If you have a dictionary, for example, you look at a dictionary and you as a human can parse it. But I guarantee you, if you took out all the size variations out of the dictionary, you took out the italics, you took out the extra punctuation, you wouldn't be able to make sense of the dictionary anymore. Because all of these things are put in there by the authors to convey information to you in a non-linguistic way. Okay? And these are the types of things that are, we think are very important to be able to ultimately understand. So, just to close here, what else is useful? We talked about these things, document, metadata, logo, signatures, those types of things important for ultimately being able to do more intelligent retrieval. Questions that we know that we can't answer with just the language content. Research, cameras captured by capturing documents. The fact that you have very low quality image capturing capability, you now have to deal with lighting, you have to deal with perspective, you have to deal with rotation. Even things like image blur, if your hand is moving a little bit as you're pushing it, those types of things, those are, you know, new areas of research. And now we're dealing with size. We have very, very large collections now, whereas before, you know, the largest collection that was put together was about 1,000 pages that actually had ground truth that people could do research on. We're here in Maryland, we're working with part of the tobacco litigation documents, all the documents that were part of the litigation cases, all the states put all their documents together. That's 49 million pages, 7 million documents there. We're taking 25,000 of them and ground truthing them down to signatures and logos for the research community. A lot of other types of parts, Google Books. You'll probably hear, how many of you have heard of Google Books? Okay, everybody, almost everybody, okay. They have literally millions and millions of books. It's kind of interesting that the model that they use. They're paying for everything, but they're pushing it out to the libraries and letting them scan. They come up with ways of doing these types of things, and unfortunately, right now they're just running regular OCR on it. But eventually, all that, those images will be available for doing those types of things, and lots of other digital libraries. Okay. So just to close, if you're interested in, there's two. Articles, one of mine that probably needs to be updated on indexing and retrieval of document images. Some of the stuff that was covered here is in there, and there was a more recent one that actually talks about it from the retrieval end. So, any questions? Or?
In terms of page decomposition categories, how many of those are there right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, anything that a publisher or you know, an author can produce. So we don't necessarily have you know, a specific set. If you're talking about the genre categories, you know, like business letters and newspapers and things like that, we typically work with 20 to 25 different ones. So forms would be one area, but then a lot of things you know, overlap. You might have tables inside of a business letter. But typically, you know, there's the business letters and then formal articles, cover pages, and, you know, journal type things, and then that different types of periodicals. And then you have, from a structured point of view, then you have other types of documents that I was saying before, that you might want to search things like phone books and those types of documents. Then you have documents that you might want to browse that have the structure of having, you know, a lot of things up front and then more of the content in the back. So it really depends on the application that you're doing, but yeah, typically 20 to 25, because after that, it's really difficult to start to distinguish between them.
I think as well, like a logo, like those sort of
things. Oh, those types of things? Oh, so individual zones, so once I have something to try to do that, probably about the same, you know, tables and forms and graphics and signatures, some of the types of things that I didn't list up here that we typically try to distinguish. Physically, stamps are one, fax headers and things like that, so different types of headers. Then when we get into the logical analysis of documents, things like page numbers, but so I thought we were going with that, you know, a number on a page at the bottom and center is meaningful. The truth of the matter is, any pixel or any mark on the page can be that way. You could have something that looks exactly like a comma. If it comes right after a word, it's right on the baseline, then it's probably a comma. But if it's over in the margin somewhere, it's probably a piece of noise. So that kind of structure is important.
Do you think tagging has anything to do with retrieval, indexing, retrieval of documents?
Tagging of, like,
the letters, papers, documents.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's almost like a, you know, one of the, if they, you know, if you build it, they will come kind of thing. I think we could provide that type, that level of metadata about documents that was consistent and it was in all documents, I think people would find a way to use it, definitely.
So I understand how you do this for like English, right? Because these letters have spaces in between them. But I've been sitting here trying to figure out what you would do for Arabic. And it doesn't seem like it would be as easy because it's written in a script, even when it's printed in a script, right?
Yep. So these are some of the big arguments that people have. There are ways to do segmentation in Arabic to segment the text. There are techniques called over-segmentation, that you do something that structurally you can tell whether that it's a segment. For example, segment every time a character crosses the baseline, every time, you know, a word comes down, you have a letter, every time it touches the baseline, you segment at those points. And then you try to put those things back together. There are also no segmentation-free techniques, hidden markup models, and different ways of viewing the sequence of pixels in the image. And then there are word-based techniques. You can do word recognition, where you extract features of the words in as a whole. Do skeletons of the words and look at the bounding contour of the words and try to match those types of things. So that's a fundamental distinction in techniques. If you see a survey on OCR, you know, segmentation-free versus segmentation.
Things developed specifically for that type of collection.
Fortunately,
like your presentation is very like, here's all the possible problems in the world, and we should be conscious of them all. But like in the stack litigation, you know, there's going to be all the single parentheses down the middle of the page.
Here's the good news. For retrieval, if you don't know what you don't have, that's sort of the Google model, you can bubble to the top the things that are important with whatever techniques you use. You know, that's why people often use very general techniques and just try to do OCR, because they know that if it's there and they can recognize it, they're going to do well. But for the most part, yes, if your goal was to do complete conversion of these types of things, then special techniques are typically adopted for a particular project. But, you know, if you're not, I think the philosophy that a lot of people have is that they have this huge stack of documents, right? And if the only other alternative is to look through the manuals. They're never going to get to the ones that are on the bottom of the stack, because every day more documents are going to get piled on the top. So if they can do something automatic and they can get 20% character accuracy or word accuracy, and they can get some of those documents bundled to the top so that they get there, that they can review them, or they can get them from an information retrieval point of view, if they can do that, get, you know, even 20%, then it's better than what they had before. So depends on what your application is. That type of application we can do well, and maybe even with a lot of generic systems. But if it's complete conversion, yeah, the quoted sort of level of accuracy for OCR for conversion versus rekeying is about 96%. If you can't do better than 96% and you want to do conversion, you're better off sending it somewhere to have it rekeyed, both in time and cost.
So. Okay, well, let's thank Dave. Not a problem. We'll take a break in just 1 minute, and then if you've got questions for Dave, maybe you can stick around for a couple minutes to answer questions one on one. But I wanted to put up something here that Dave reminded me. I had brought him something from Japan that he doesn't yet know about. A present for me,
for you.
So I was in Kamakura, and I was thinking of you, and I saw this, and I said, perhaps they can do something with this, so I'll send you this one.
All right.
I also have an English version, so if you want to learn translations.
Very good. All right.
The English
good.
The,
yeah, of course, I've done the habit of taking my camera with me and taking pictures of science and stuff like that in all different countries I go to. Very good. Thank you.
Great. So let's take a break.
Do you use the computer?
nearly as much as I should. I'm going to today because I'm doing a
Thank you.
certainly would have really helped.
Yeah.
Going from my current education background to a master's would be a big jump. Especially going from a master's to a PhD,
they have to like be kids with each other for a while. And so they come in and they have cookies and milk and it is in a lab, right? Well, it's a kid lab. It's got little tables, right? You can actually see it on the second floor. Just come out of the elevator, come right. So anyway, and they were asking each other these really stupid jokes, right? And to which they all knew the answer. And one of them would ask and the other one would answer and they would all laugh. And I thought, that must have been how I was when I thought this was funny, right? And so the funny thing is not how do you shoot a blue elephant with a blue elephant gun. The question is, how do you shoot a red elephant? Now, when I learned it, it was a pink elephant, but Wikipedia has it as a red elephant, right? So how do you shoot a red elephant? What's that? Right. You can't use a red elephant gun, right? Because there are no red elephant guns.
Funny, right? Yeah.
Okay?
So we're blue elephant guns, but not red ones, so for some strange reason, there are no red ones. But you can hold his nose till it turns blue, and then you can shoot it with a blue elephant gun, right? Which will work, because now it's blue.
That's it! So everything we're going to do for the rest of the semester is the blue elephant gun, right? So what we do is we take something like a scan document, we hold its nose until it turns blue, right? Now we've got a bunch of words. We just do the usual thing, right? And then later, if we want to do speech, we'll just find a way to hold its nose until it turns blue, and we'll do the usual thing, right? We can do foreign language. It doesn't really matter, right? We'll just find some way of holding its nose until it turns blue. Okay? So that's the basic idea that sort of sets you up for the rest of the semester. And that's what this first hour was about. That's how you hold its nose. Right? All that stuff we just talked about. So the only thing left to be talked about is, now what do we do? Right? Now that it's turned blue, what is the blue open going to look like? Okay. Now, you can do this to lots of problems. So, every problem has this characteristic. That if I make my conversion better, the holding of the nose, engineers call it transducers because it sounds like you should set the lights. Okay, so if I make my transducer better, and what this is how many accurately recognized words can you get out of how many words did they speak or write or do whatever they did, right? So if they wrote like a billion words and you get two of them right, then you're like way over here. And if there are a billion words and you got a billion minus two of them right, you're over here. Right? And all these problems have this characteristic, that when they're really, really bad as transducers, we can't do anything. They just sit here randomly guessing characters, right? And we put the characters into randomly guessed words, and what's the chance that's what they really said? Pretty close to zero. And so there's nothing we can do, right? And Dave was talking about this. He was saying, you know, well, that 80% we do this, and that 70% we do this, and after that we give up. Right? So everything has this characteristic that if it's really good, then fine. Then my IR performance is pretty good. If it's really bad, then my IR performance is really bad. And there's some point in the middle that those folks from 718 will recognize. Where all of a sudden things start getting really good, really fast. So this OCR problem is really good. And if I make my OCR better, nothing happens because it was already really good. Right. So I'm sort of off the top of the plateau. Handwriting is way down here. It's really bad. And if I make it better, it's still really bad. Right? I have to make it quite a lot better before I start to get to the point where I can do something interesting. Okay. Now, when we get to speech, it's here. So if you're a researcher, you go like, beaming camera, right? Because if I make my speech a little bit better, I can search a lot more stuff. So this is where researchers spend their time, right? Researchers are bored with this stuff because you make the OCR a little bit better, who cares, right? So this is where practitioners are. So we've got things like Google Books, right? But we don't have any Google handwriting. Clear why? Yeah. And we don't have Google Speech yet. I mean, we got Google Video, but we don't have Google Audio, right? And it's hard. But if you wait long enough, it'll get better. Now, the funny thing on this graph that might not leap out at you, and that's the label on the y-axis, this vertical axis. When we make mistakes, we don't make mistakes on a word-by-word basis. If I get something wrong on a page, it's often because I got the page wrong. You know, like I scanned it upside down, and I just, nothing, right? So it's correlated errors. when I make a mistake in one place, I make a mistake in another place. I've got a speech recognition system that can recognize people speaking English. Somebody comes along with a thick German accent speaking English, it gets everything they say wrong. Because it's never heard anybody with a thick German accent before, right? So when I make mistakes at the scale of what Dave very helpfully defined for us as a document, this natural grouping of things with the beginning and end, right? And so what happens is, as you move out this curve, you start to pick up not words, which is what you might have thought of if you listened to, you know, if you thought about character error rates or word error rates. You pick up documents. So now you've got, you know, you can search essentially almost no documents. And then after a while, with speech, you can search some fraction of the documents. But the ones you can search very well. Right? And so that's what makes this interesting, is that we're picking up a searchable fraction of the documents. Right? And so you want to know with each of these problems, with any other problems people come up with for you, where you are on the test curve. Because it's not straight. Make sense?
Okay. What's that?
What's that?
MT.
Oh, machine translation. So this is
that one.
Right? Convert that into something I can search using an English query. Okay. Yeah, so machine translation is interesting because several years ago, here. Right? And it's recently been doing this. At the same time, the speech has been doing this. So all the researchers have shifted their attention to here and are ignoring this. And the practitioners haven't yet picked up this, which is sitting there ready to go. But there's no working system. So there's no way to go and look and say, oh, that's what we need to do, because you've never seen it before. Right? So this is sort of ready to be done. So there's actually a problem when you get up here. There's a problem down here with the researchers recognizing that it's ready. There's a problem down here with the practitioners recognizing that it's ready. Right? So you have to build an industry here, and you have to build a research community here. Make sense? Okay. Okay, so I told you this at the beginning. This is the big picture. I lied and told you that you have to do three things. You have to do four things. So you have to find the words. Well, that's what holding a nose till it turns blue does, right? So we've got this mess, and then we put it through the demessifier, and we get just the words, and then we put that through the OCR, and we get the character codes for the words, and then we declare victory, and we say, okay, fine, I got the character codes, I'm happy, right? So that's find the words. And once we found the words, we index the words. Now, we do all of this in advance. So if this part is slow, well, it's not a big deal as long as it's not so slow that it takes, you know, from the Ice Age up until now. Right? So we can do all that in advance. Then we do rank retrieval, and then we use that system to find what you want. Now, this part of it is very specific to images, right? So we've got dots on a page or dots on a screen when we start. And when we're done, we've got character codes, right? And maybe we've got field labels or an XML structured representation or something like that. Indexing of the words isn't too different. I'm going to try to get rid of the stop words. I'm going to try to stem things. I'm pretty much going to do the same basic things we've been doing, make all the term independence assumptions. So, you know, Dave was sitting here saying, it's really hard. You really need people like me. It's really hard. And I'm like, it's really easy. In my job, all I got to do after you're done is count the words. You put out whatever you feel like, I'll count them. Right? So it's not really hard. You just got to put out something I can count. Okay. So this part of it's easy. Funny things happen when you do this, though. Let's say that I have a word like training, okay? T-R-A-I-N-I-N-G, to train somebody. And I as I'm doing the OCR, I get the N recognized as II. Right? So I missed the little part across the top. Maybe because it's been Xerox several times or something. Or maybe I just have a lousy OCR system. So OCR systems make certain kinds of errors. They never take an N and replace it with a Z. That was probably too strong, but it's uncommon. But to take an N and break it into two I's, that's much more common. Okay? So now I've got T-R-A-I-I-I-N-G. Yeah? So now what happens to triag? Well, it lands up getting indexed, right? And how many times does it appear in the collection? So it appears once. So what kind of IDF does it have? Really high, right? As high as you can possibly get. So if you ask about training, it's an ordinary word. But triading, whatever that is, really, really, really good. Now, if anybody comes along and they ask about training, the training thing will be ignored. It will never matter. Right? Because nobody would ask about that in their query. Unless they type their query in on paper and then scan it in their OCR. That'd be really stupid, right? No one would do that.
The OCR has to do the same
mistake. And the OCR makes the same mistake. And now, oh my God, it'll find traying, and it'll be so happy with it that all the rest of your query terms will be ignored. Because they just have ordinary IDFs, where this one's got a really super IDF, right? See the problem? Now, why would anybody type their query, print it out, scan it in, and OCR it? With a query?
Uh-huh.
I suppose you might. Nobody?
What?
He said to find common OCR mistake. Someone faxed you a reference request? Seems a little far-fetched, but okay, it's closer.
You're trying to find similar documents.
Ah! The query is a document. I found the document I wanted. It's got this word training in it and a thousand other words. I don't really know what a good query would be, but that's okay. I'll just issue all words in this document as my query. I hope you all are putting that in your system. I mean, because it'd be really useful, right? If I find something on topic, I can find other things that are on topic. So now I've got this system that... Well, it's a design feature you could consider. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So... Now I've got this screwed up query that will match my screwed up my one screwed up document, and boy, will that rise to the top. So I have to find a way to prune out these singletons, right? To say, well, we don't see T-R-A-I-I-I, and we never really see I-I-I in any English word, right? So how am I going to do that? Where am I going to find out what common characteristics I see of sequences of characters?
The language model.
Right? I'll look for characters that occur in this sequence, and I'll say, oh, that III doesn't never occurs in the Wall Street Journal. It occurs only in my OCR output. Here, let's just suppress it. Let's downweight it by how likely it is to see this. And in fact, every time I see III, I saw IN or NI in the corresponding clean text. Right? If you have a translation model. You can actually learn to translate from lousy OCR to good text on a character by character basis using the same techniques people use for machine translation.
But if you suppress it at every time, if you learn it, if you have the translation model, you can find it, but
But if you, but otherwise, if you suppress it, you will lose this one because of the OCR error. So instead of the OCR error getting a capture effect, the OCR error will get thrown on the floor. Whether that's good or bad depends upon your application. If you want to find everything, then you don't mind if it gets a capture effect, but you're going to have to look through an awful lot of stuff if you're a recall-oriented searcher. If you're a precision-oriented searcher, that capture effect really gets in the way because it brings a lot of stuff up to number one. Now, let's consider the case of a searcher who will, good for us, actually type the query in. Now, I told you that they're not going to they're not going to type in a query T-R-A-I-I-I-N-G, so they're not going to match on the misrecognized document. Now, if they have a long query, if they're interested in, you know, training of, I don't know, something in the paper about the things they put on the back of the whales recently, right? So training of whale inserters or whatever they do. Those people must be trained, right? So they must have some, there must be some papers about how those people are trained. Okay, so now I got they're training whale, beacon or whatever it is they call their things, right? So I've got lots of words now. And I've got some documents that have really lousy recognition. Not only is T-R-A-I-I-I-N-G wrong, but lots of things are bad because this is just a poorly Xeroxed document, right? Or it had a lot of skew that we hadn't corrected for, right? So I've got these correlated errors. What's the chance that I'm going to kill all of my query terms? Pretty high because I've got correlated errors, right? So now let's say that I have just a simple thought experiment for you. Let's say I've got two classes of documents, really good documents and really lousy documents, right? I mean, like old faxes that I Xeroxed 18 times on one side, and on the other side, just crisp reproductions of things that I just printed and scanned back in just an accident, right? So if I issue a query, how many of the really lousy documents, you know, three-word query, three good query terms, how many of the lousy documents do you think I'm going to get? None. Right? How many of the really good ones do you think I'm going to get? Most of them. Yeah? So IR systems sort well-recognized documents ahead of poorly recognized documents naturally. All you have to do is issue a query. And the query will naturally select the documents that are well recognized and naturally reject the others. Now you're probably thinking to yourself, well, wait a minute, what if an error turns one word into another word and the other word it turned it into is my query term? It's like, okay, but what's the chance that would have happened three times in the same document to the three things you happen to pick as query terms? The errors in bad documents scatter those documents all over the word space. They decorrelate the words. Right? The words are unrelated to each other. Whereas the good documents, with any luck, the people are writing about what's being asked about in queries, because the people writing queries are trying to pick queries that have words that they expect to find in documents. So they're actually doing exactly what you want. They're probing for the well-recognized documents. So you can measure this effect. What's the error rate near the top of the rank list compared with what's the error rate across the whole collection? And you get a lower error rate near the top of the rank list because there's this sorting effect. With me so far? Okay.
So if you're trying to find something in a bad document, you'll never get it.
So if you have a bad document and you have a long query, several words, the chance that and there are other good documents on the same topic.
There are no good documents.
But if there are no good documents, then one of the words might match. You know, one of your query terms might have been recognized correctly. Right? Okay. So what we just talked about is the accuracy selection effect in rank retrieval. We can take advantage of that. Let's say that I have
a document that I think has been recognized reasonably well, but maybe not perfectly. So this traing thing, T-R-A-I-I-I-N-G, might have occurred in this document. And I want to insert into this document the word training. So here's a trick that I can use. I can take the document and issue it as a query, just like we talked about, relevance feedback, right? Doing the protection trick that we talked about to remove the words that have I on them because they don't occur. Now I've got back a set of documents that have words in them very much like the words that are in my original, there's no query, very much like the words that are in my original document, the document that I wanted to improve. But you remember, I'd thrown out a word from this original document. And now I want to replace it. So I'll just go find all the similar documents, and I'll make a list of which words occur most often in the similar documents. What do you think that'll be? Be the most common words in English, right? If I stop worded it, it'll be the next most common words in English. That's what I'm going to find. So that wouldn't work. But I could ask the question, which are the highest IDF terms that I find? Which are the most unexpected terms that are correlated with presenting this, right? Or which terms distinguish the set of retrieved documents from all the rest of the collection the best? Which are most surprisingly present in this set? All right, so I just take the top 10 documents. This is called blind relevant feedback. It's just like relevant feedback. It's as if I told you these were the right documents. I take the top 10 documents, and I take terms out of those top 10 documents, and I add them to the document. And there's every chance I'm going to find that training was correlated with all the other words that showed up here, and thus was selected highly and put it back in. But of course, I'm going to pick up a bunch of other terms too, right? I'm not going to know that training is the right thing to pick up. What kind of terms do you think I'll get?
Is that the word for the veil?
Yeah. So I get the word for the veil, but I already have the word for the veil in my document, right? But a document about it. But I'm going to get synonyms for whales, right? Whales are mammals, right? So probably, you know, I'll pick up mammals or something. Because mammals be mentioned a lot when whales are mentioned, because it's marine mammals that are getting, heavily struck. Right? Or I'll get marine. I'll get words that are related. That's not so bad. I'm taking my document and putting synonyms in. So this is actually a good trick to do generally. But if I have a bad transducer, it's not too bad. It can help clean me up. So this can pick up 10% for you or something as a trick. Right? It's sort of a reinsertion of misrecognized terms and related terms. Good thing? Okay. So we took the fact that we had this accuracy selection effect and we used it to do enhancement. Two other points I want to pick up from what Dave said. Did you notice with shape codes, did you get the idea how shape codes work? So did you notice from shape codes that he was looking at things that weren't words anymore, but they still worked for retrieval? You see how that, did you get the idea for how that works?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't actually have to recognize words in order to do IR. Right? I mean, we developed the idea that we were going to do words, and then we're going to get word stems. Word stems weren't words in the first place, right? Nobody actually said the stem, right? But we're using stems because what we did was we took several words and we said, we'll represent all of these equivalent words as the stem. Right? So what Dave said is, now we'll take several words that all have the same shape and we'll represent them as the shape code, the set of shape codes. So you could go further. We can represent every word as one. That wouldn't work, right? We'd represent every word the same way. We couldn't tell the words apart anymore. So there's some maximum distance you can go here, right? So, how many letters are there in English? 26. How many shape codes do I need? I mean, if I have one shape code, you're going to tell me I'm not doing well, right? But you could do this experiment, right? You could take the characters in English, and you could replace A through N with A, and A through M with A, and N through Z with Z. And then you could recode every English word using those codes, and you could do the same thing for your query, and you could try to match. And you'd find out that two wasn't enough. So then you could break it into three, break it into four. Right? So we start with 26 letters, which is really 52 letters because they come in upper and lower case. It's really 62 because we can get some numbers, and it's really more than that. Fluctuation. So it's like 64. Okay? So we've got 54 possibilities. You can map those things down to, I don't know, 20 or so, 10, 15, without too much trouble. Now, let's say that I had some way of mapping it down to 15 based on shape. And I want to play a game with you now. I'm going to tell you which words you have to select between. Or actually, I'll ask you, is this word? Right? And it's a one-character word. Right? A. Well, your shape code is going to confuse an O for an A, and you're not going to be able to answer. Right? Now, what happens if my word is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious? Right? You see how, as my word gets longer, the shape code is going to cause me less trouble. Because I've got these 12 different possibilities, and I'm going to encode them. I'm going to encode the shapes, but there are no words that have the same shape as supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, except that one, right? Or entity-disintegrationistic. Okay. So the trick is here, shape codes destroy my ability to distinguish short words, but they don't harm my ability very much to distinguish long words. Now, which words have higher idea? Short words or long words? Long words, right? Long words are less commonly used. We have some sort of efficiency in our construction of words. So that's why shape codes work. Shape codes work because it's long words that we're searching. Shape codes are not good for just matching single words, but they're really good for matching several long words.
That's how the Washington letters system works without shape codes?
To a first approximation, yes. Okay. Right, I mean, they have all sorts of problems that they have to figure out the skew with which the handwriting was written, so they have to de-skew that before they can do the shape codes. Okay. Right, because otherwise they wouldn't break up nicely. They'd break up like this. Okay. So, this is going to come up again when we do speech. The shape codes, if you want to think of it this way, Dave didn't introduce us this way, but you can think of shape codes as sort of pre-recognition. First I figure out what shape this thing is, and then among the things that are of that shape, I guess which one I saw. And I get the shape right most of the time, right? I mean, it'd be hard to get wrong. But which thing of that shape it was, an A or an E or an O, that's hard, right? So, the reason you do shape codes isn't so much to improve retrieval effectiveness, although it does get you away from the spelling mistake problem a little bit. But the reason why you do shape codes is because you only have to do half the retrieval process. You don't have to spend time. So you can recognize a whole lot more stuff without spending the time to run the recognition process all the way through. Because all that image processing is exceedingly expensive. Did you see Dave had a flow chart at one point? And it said 3 seconds for this, 2 seconds for that, 5 seconds for that. That's per page, right? So if I've got the Library of Congress, it's going to be a lot of seconds before it's online. Or if I've got Google Books, it's going to be a lot of seconds before I have that thing searchable. So what shape codes do is they take half of that and just throw away. So I do, I solve half the recognition problem and declare victory. And it, and then I can measure the effect on information retrieval. And it's small. As long as I have enough different shapes distinguished, and the query terms are long enough, and there are enough of the query terms. Because all those things are trying to help me recover from bad mistakes. And I was making mistakes in the first place because you were saying happy and all I had was glad and I missed it. So I'm making mistakes left and right anyway. Right? And this doesn't add very many. Okay. So this comes up again with speech because we'll do our speech recognition all the way down until we can find out what kind of grunts and groans you made. And then we'll just have brain groan engrams. That'll be it. And that'll work. To a degree. So I'll tell you where that fails when we get there. Okay, so that's that. Now here's the last part. Let's say that I have shape codes, just to be extreme, but we could also have kind of raunchy OCR. That'd be the same. You wouldn't want to read it, right? But I'll put up shape codes and you just can't read it. Right? It's kind of like trying to read something written in stems. It's like, okay, you kind of get the idea. So now I've got this thing that's recognized to nothing but shape codes. Now, most of what I find isn't what you're looking for. Right? So you need to find what you're looking for. All I do is rank it. You know, but I can't rank it very well, so I'm just going to put the best stuff I can find near the top, and then the next best stuff, and the next best stuff, and then you're going to go down the list until you find what you're looking for, right? So what should I show to you in the list? Should I show you the shape codes? No. Okay. So you see where we have a little bit of a problem here? So I got my rank retrieval and it's kind of working okay, and when it doesn't work, it just kind of misses lots of stuff, but the stuff that's recognized okay is it's doing reasonably well, right? So I got this rank list, and now you have to scan the list. And I can't show you the shape codes or the lousy OCR or whatever it is that I used to find it for you. So what do I show you? The scanned image, right? But I have a problem now. Yeah, I just used up the whole screen for one document. So now you're sitting here flipping the screen, right? Let's look at the next document. But instead of being able to just scan down and see the summary, so what do I do? What? Here. What do I do? And how do I do that?
Find the shape code area that matches.
Okay, so I get Dave to segment it so that every word has its own little block. Right? And then when I decide that I like this shape code in my summary because it's my query term, I say, I just take that little block and copy it over and stick those pixels in my summary. Got it? Okay. So Dave's thinking we're doing this decomposition to do some very complicated processing later on, and I'm like, oh man, I'm just going to steal words and stick them in my summary. All right, I'm going to do the same thing I was doing before, except I got a human that can read the pixels. All right, we'll just give back the pixels instead of using a font to regenerate the characters. Works beautifully. All right, because if the pixels are right, the user will know that's the right thing. And if the pixels are wrong, it won't take the user very long to figure out that that's not what they wanted. You know, you sit here, you're highlighting a term, you think it's the query term, and the user's like rolling on the floor laughing. Probably not the right thing, because they can read the pixels. Got it? Okay. So look what's happened now. First, we had to find the word. What did we do originally? We found the bits, we put the bits together into the characters, we put the characters together into the words, right? That's what we did with character coded text. Now we gotta find a different way of squeezing the elephant's trunk. Right? Okay, so we did that. So in IR, from document images, Finding the words, very different. Then, index the words. Pretty similar, but we might have some of this filtering stuff going on. Yes? Or enhancements, right? So pseudo-relevancy, blind relevancy. Then we do ranked retrieval. So this, we just do the same tricks we've had in the past after we get the index right. It pretty much stays the same. And then we use the system differently by showing you a different kind of a summary made of pixels, or a different document, a document made of pixels, right? And of course, we can highlight things in the document, show you where you're partnering. So it's the same except it's different. And this is the basic idea of this part of the class, is that you've learned a way of doing it, and part of what you learned was specific to the fact that it was character-coded text. And you didn't know which part that was, and part of it was a general strategy. And now that you've seen a second example, you can tell which part it was, which things changed, which things stayed the same. Okay? And so now we'll do that again, and again, and again. Future words. Okay. So I want to talk about a few applications to give you an idea of what people really do with this stuff. There's a company here in College Park that if you get sued, you can hire a garbage truck, put all your documents in the garbage truck, drive the garbage truck to College Park, pull up in front of the company that does the document imaging, which is in the basement. Garbage truck dumps all the stuff in, and then these people down there in the basement, they just feed it through scanners. Right, so they have a bunch of very low paid people who just feed it through scanners. Right? And when they're done, they throw away your documents because you don't need it anymore. They're already scanned. Right? And now you can search your entire paper document. And you don't have to think about it, you just have to write a check for the people that feed these things into the scanner. Right? So you can see where Dave's problem comes from, right? It comes from that problem. Right? We got no idea what's coming in, we don't know if it's right side up or upside down, we don't know if it's, you know, a printed email, or a business letter, or a book. You know, we have no idea what we're getting. Everything goes through the big maw and comes out the shredder on the other side. Right? Okay, anyway, so that's a company that does that. And they do it for case management for litigation. I get sued, I want to know what I've got. And then you're going to ask me, can I please have everything that incriminates you? And I'm going to be like, well, let's see, what do you exactly mean by incriminate? Right? We could maybe agree on a query here. Look, I'll search for the, right? You know, and they're like, no, no, would you please search for, you know, Enron shareholder fraud or something. I'm like, how about the fraud? And I search for the fraud. And, you know, so you have this big negotiation, and then after a while, you search for it, and then you give the other side as many documents as you want. Right?
Print it out.
Well, yes, of course, you reprint them
first. They can't search them all.
Well, they have to then hire the same company to do the dump truck business on the printed documents that you send them. But you can't send them the original documents because you've lost the association between the image and the documents. That's the physically hard part, is to go back and get the original document, right? So that's why in this the image then becomes king. Right? Okay. Now, you might think this sounds very arcane and nobody would really do it. But next week, remember I told you about these people in Gaithersburg? Right? So these people in Gaithersburg did was they went and they got 7 million of these documents that had been through the dump truck process, and they hired a bunch of lawyers, and the lawyers negotiated queries. First, they made up lawsuits, right? So they're just thinking, there was one that was accusing some company of having a a machine that would suck out the bad smoke from your lungs, you know, or something like that. And so they had some advertising campaign. It's a mythical advertising campaign for this machine. And so they took the real documents from the real tobacco company, and they made up these mythical lawsuits. And then they hired, then they got some lawyers and they negotiated on opposite sides, the bullying clerks. And then they hired a set of relevance assessors to do the homework, except they did it 5,000 documents at a time, right? And these were people trained that were lawyers that would have actually done this in reality. Right. So we actually figured out what it cost. It was several hundred thousand dollars worth of lawyer time to generate the relevance judgments. And then they had a competition for a bunch of people who built IR systems to build the best IR systems, you know, that would allow for all the OCR errors and stuff like that. So the OCR had all 7 million documents. And this year, for the second time in a row, next week on Tuesday, everybody's getting together to talk about how well their systems work. Right. And we still can't beat a system that does a Boolean search, which is a little scary. Okay, so that's one application. So it's real, people are really doing it with a real dump truck and a real place in the basement in College Park. And it's deeply ingrained now in the IR community as a challenge problem to try to figure out how to deal with this stuff. And for example, something like 200,000 of the 7 million documents are emails, printed emails. So you'd like to model, you know, to and from and stuff like that. But can you imagine how that stuff comes through OCR? Right? They're printed on dot matrix printers. Just, that's what you do if you really want to make yourself, right? You get dot matrix printers and you print them and then scan them and direct them. Okay. Here's another one. About 15 years ago, there was an executive order signed that said that you have to declassify everything that's more than, 20 years old or something like that. Unless you reviewed it and found out that it is that it is sensitive by, you know, one of the following 15 categories. Right? But otherwise, you just have to get it. And before that, the deal was, if you had time, you could look at it. And if you looked at it and you found out it wasn't sensitive, you could let people see it. But that changed the rule to, if you didn't have time to look at it, other people would look at it for you and they would tell you if it was sensitive. Right? And so this got people thinking, we have to find a way to get much more efficient at looking at this stuff. And so they said, what can you guys do for us in OCR? And it turned out that OCR was sort of like the least of the problems. So here's what you want to do. I'm given the dump truck full of top secret documents now, right? And what I want to do is I want to sort all of these documents so that every copy of the same document is sorted into one bin, and I can just make a decision once on that document. In practice, what you do is go through the document, and if you've ever seen the same document before, you should just get alerted and told what decision you made the last time. That's actually the way it happened, because people kept finding these things in, you know, top secret apps. Right? So we kept showing. So now, for every document I get, I simply want to search every prior document, see if I've seen it before. This is exactly the problem of example-based retrieval, except this one's so very simple, because everything in the previous document is identical. All the logos are the same, all the words are the same, everything's the same. Except the way it's scanned. So the dots aren't the same. Well, and except for the handwritten note that somebody put on this one. So the handwritten note's not the same. Well, and except for this one has a page break in a different place. But otherwise it's exactly the same document. But I printed it on, you know, I got a new computer, and when I loaded it in, the page break came out. Right?
A copy today.
This one's got a copy today. You see the problem now? Yeah. And what they were really worried about wasn't so much becoming so much more productive. It was that if this time I say, oh, I have to black this part out, and the next time I have to black that part out, Right? Yeah, well, yeah, just, yeah, I mean, you know, so somebody gets the documents and say, hey, look, it's the same document, and this one's got that part blacked out, and this one's got that part blacked out, so now I have the whole document again. And you can read these regularly in the Washington Post, right, where they find cases where this has happened, and they tell you what it is was blacked out. Right? And you're looking like, why would they want to black out that? You know. Okay, so they didn't want to be embarrassed. So they had to do duplicate detection so they could do anti-tiling, right? Because that's what happens. If I show you the decision you made last time, you can say, oh yeah, that was a good decision. Here, let's do it again, right? Whereas if you don't know what you did last time, you might black out some other part. Okay, so those are a couple of things that people have done. And one of the really interesting things that came out of this one is that nobody really knows what a duplicate is, right? Because duplicate has got all these different kinds of meanings. Okay, now here's the really nasty one. Did you ever see the cartoon, or not the cartoon, the commercial where they're saying, oh, poor Bob, Bob's dead, you know, and it's like, yes, but he's not really gone, right? Because we have everything Bob ever Xeroxed, right? And inside their Xerox machine, they have a copy of everything Bob ever Xeroxed, and it's too bad about Bob, but we haven't really lost everything Bob knew, right? Have you seen this?
No.
You've never seen this commercial. So it was some company selling the fact that their Xerox remembered stuff. It's like, and I got really nervous after that, you know, because guessing on Xerox, so they didn't want anybody to know. Well, it's her Xerox remembers stuff. I've been looking for wires coming out the back. And of course now copiers are standards, right? They, you know, you connect it to the computer network, you just walk over to the copier and do it. So you don't think it's remembering everything you're copying, right? So if I ever need to find any of that stuff again, what do my queries look like if my colleagues ever need to find any of that stuff again? I mean, you know, sure, we'll do this all with our emails and our web pages and stuff like that, but now we can do it with all the physical stuff as well. Okay, so that's another application. Okay, so let me just show you a demo, instead of everybody getting on at the same time. I'll walk you through a couple of these. So the first one is the tobacco settlement. So what happened was, the tobacco settlement was a lawsuit with the states, and the state lawsuits, when they were settled, required that the tobacco companies deposit all the documents that they had released with some institute, which donated them all to the University of California, San Francisco, which built a system to support searchers who wanted to do research on tobacco issues. Right? And so that's where this came from. So what do you want to know about tobacco stuff? Joe Camel? What's that?
Health benefits.
Health benefits?
Of tobacco.
How do you spell tobacco?
1D and 2D.
You're assuming you knew it was an O,
but it's written right here.
Okay. Health benefits of tobacco. Okay, here's the health benefits of quitting smoking. Tobacco use and health risks and benefits of using tobacco. The benefits of using tobacco as perceived by users. Does that look like the one you want to see? So, I mean, this is everything Dave was telling you, right? Yes, Scott. It's got all that junk up at the top. You know, try to recognize that. See, here's the inverse, you know, inverse text. You can see how you make some of those ends into IIs. Okay, so that's one. Let's see. Find another one. Here's a memorandum. You can see there's a lot of metadata that got put on these.
because the tobacco companies were a little nervous, and they built it into their search system. Okay, so there's a memorandum that's pretty much almost exactly what they were telling you. You know, and here's the place where they wrote the Bates number sideways. That's the number they use in the court cases to keep all these things straight. Letter.
Do you think that display in the table list was BOCR?
So that's a great question. Where is this coming from? Ingalls number one, instead of providing the benefits of the proposed resolution, a continuation of the state cases would have three potential outcomes, none of which are attractive from a public interest standpoint. So that looks like it's coming out of OCR, right? It's free text. But then up here, which collection it came out of, how many pages, what the base number is, the type, and the date if available, those things are on the collection as metadata. And there's a very complex metadata format that varies by source. There are seven different sources in this collection. But it's got an intersection that is essentially what you see there. Yeah, you can see down here they had a little problem. It said OCR 3-star ?? AQTION. I mean, they're actually not AC blank TION. That's pretty clear what's going to happen here. Right. So this is the bad design. Don't do this. Right. They could have shown you the image, and you would have had it better than what you get. Okay. So take Google Books for a minute. Okay, so what do you want to find a book on? Tobacco. Whole purpose of tobacco?
Chemical mascot with tobacco.
What's that?
Mascot with tobacco.
Mascot?
Yeah. Like Joe Camel. Yeah. And then Joe Camel, whatever the heck.
Tobacco mascots. Preventing Tobacco Use Among Young People, report for the Surgeon General from 1997. There it is. And look what they've done here. They've highlighted the word tobacco, except that the highlighting goes halfway down to the next line. Okay. So they've got a little registration problem that they've gone through, and they found this area has that word. They don't know exactly where the word's going to show up, so they just put a big blob on it. It draws your eye. See what else we have on the health benefits of tobacco. This is all very recent. The Vanishing Legion, a history of mascot pictures. Freedom to Smoke. In 1959, Popular Mechanics. Okay. So look what happened here. They don't show you the page. They just show you a little piece of the page. How come?
Copyright.
The first thing I showed you, ain't nobody going to sue you, right? It was a public document, right? This is under copyright. And so they snip out a little piece and show you the piece and claim fair use.
It's magical.
What's that?
Magical.
All right, so the last one I'll show you. Here's George Washington's famous. Okay, try me. What do you want to search? You can only pick one word. They recommend provision or Washington. Are you getting the idea that this isn't going to work very well? What do you think Washington wrote about besides provision and, not surprisingly, Washington?
Liberty.
What's that?
Liberty.
Liberty. I'm sorry, you were going to go for death if this didn't work?
No, tobacco.
Tobacco. Okay, hold on, let's do liberty. Let's see what Washington had to say about liberty. This is while he's fighting the war, right? Okay, so in the first place, it's not too sure it knows how to find liberty, right? Okay, and then here you see what they've done. They found the document, and here's where they think they got liberty.
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay, how about here?
That doesn't look too good.
It's probably England.
You want England? Okay.
British.
Well, there's a lot. I will try England first.
How about English?
How about what?
Queen.
English?
Queen.
Queen.
Why?
Wasn't it a king then?
English.
Yeah. Okay, so this is England that it's trying to do. It's not so sure that it knows what England is. Captain, no, I don't think so. Hero, no, perhaps, I don't think so. It just does not look like it's a winning proposition here. What English, I think we should go for tobacco.
Jefferson.
Sorry, no results for English. Jefferson?
Got a unique shape.
Sorry, no results for Jefferson.
Can we try without it? Give without as one of the results.
Without. Okay, it's happier with without than it's been with any word so far. But it didn't decide.
John Maiden.
Maybe he never said without.
No, the funny thing that we said the first thing was without.
Oh, well. Let's try provision.
Maybe they hide for their
dad. Dude, it works really well. Okay, so two lessons here. One is, if you work on handwriting recognition, don't put demos on the web. And the second is, it doesn't work very well.
Hey.
Oh, we found provisions, provisions. Look at how well provision works. Provisions, provision. Okay. Okay, so what it's doing is it's taking the thing you typed in, it's trying to make it into sort of fake George Washington. Guess how George Washington would have written that, and then trying to find it. So it's got to go through two steps.
One of the unique problems with that set was there was actually four separate areas that wrote for him, so I had to learn four different handwriting styles.
I wonder if anybody told these people that.
I think so, that's where I got it from. Because he did from a page where the notation
doesn't work. Soldier works really well.
Does it?
Yes.
Okay, Soldier will do, and then we take a quick stretch break. And then I owe you a description of what to do for next week. You can actually take your stretch break while I look for something. So what this is really good for is if you find an instance of Washington talking about Soldier, then you actually don't have to go through the translation step. Then you can find all other instances of Washington talking about Soldier. Of course, it has to be capitalized similarly and written by the same secretary and all those things. But you can get the you can do manuscript collections where you find one instance of something and they find the other places where this person wrote that word. And these techniques will work fairly well for that. Okay, we got soldiers, 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 soldier, soldiers. And on that note, we can take a short break.
Email address.
What's that?
Provisions, Washington, and Soldiers.
That's the favorite. Yeah.
And so you knew them.
Right. So they're pulling out images from Amazon and you go in and it's showing
you. But it's
the Mark record.
It's only what's in their collection?
It's only what's in their collection. They have
to
translate Voyager into their Voyager catalog into this. And then they're also then pulling information from the web about it. And in theory, they'll also be the manuscript that's pulled in to the digital library.
Okay.
So their
digital library is the search system there,
so that all their different search systems are now in one.
Cool.
Plus you've got the extra information that is all open source. And they were saying that the front end stuff is designed to be very CSS heavy, so that if you download this, you can plug in your Maryland file sheet and make it look like your Maryland catalog, so your students know visually that they're searching something in Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and not Villanova.
Very good.
So it's pretty good stuff.
Yeah, if you can send me the email for that, I'll definitely help. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's not the value is actually that they can search the whole document on the scene. So they actually have
to. They have to produce the entire thing.
So they're benefiting by looking at the entire document and pretending that by showing them the confidence that they're not extracting value. Yeah.
So are you going to go do Google Maps?
Okay, so I have a confession to make. If you go to the homework or to the project assignment due 2 weeks from now, it says it will be provided by the beginning of the semester. Now, in my defense, I didn't say which semester. But in any case, that will be up within 2 days. But in the meantime, this one may keep you busy enough. This is the batch evaluation design. Now, can I safely assume everybody's read it so I don't have to read it to you? What questions do you have? If any.
Why are we doing evaluation before we even have a system?
Ah, okay. So, it's a lovely question. There are two reasons. One is general for all system building. If you know what it is you intend to build, then you can specify how it should work well enough to specify an evaluation. If you can't specify an evaluation, you don't actually yet understand what it is you're going to build. So one way of testing your design is to explain how you would measure how well it's doing. Then you would have to articulate what it's supposed to do, what constitutes doing that well, and the additional part of how you would measure. You don't actually do the measurement, but articulating how you would measure how well something is working has something to do with what it is it's supposed to do. If you know what it's supposed to do, you can do that easily. If you don't know what it's supposed to do, it will reveal that to you, and it will help you to work through the process of design. So you'll find very commonly in design processes that people will design the functionality and then the evaluation. Right, so it's common in software engineering, right? You design the acceptance test before you have the software. Because, I mean, crying out loud, it's supposed to do the thing it's supposed to do, not whatever it is it actually does, it's supposed to do what it said in the spec it was supposed to do. Okay? So that's one reason. The second reason is that evaluations are very expensive. Now, what does it mean to be expensive? Well, in this case, it means it takes time to prepare for and to conduct. Batch evaluations take time to prepare for, but not to conduct. User studies take time to conduct, but maybe not as much time to prepare for. So the batch evaluation comes before the user evaluation in the planning process so that you have the lead time to prepare the resources. Also, you'll want to make sure it's doing what it's supposed to do automatically before you put a user in front of it, because if the user tells you it's bad and then the batch evaluation tells you it's ranking things poorly, you're like, well, not surprisingly, the user will think that's bad. But if it's ranking things well, the user still might think it's bad for other reasons, right? Interface design reasons, interaction design reasons. So if you do the evaluation design early, you'll get an idea of what resources need to be built. And then you can say to each other, I don't want to build that. You should build that, right? And since you have 6 people, you can do that for quite a long time. Does that make sense? For the timing of it? Okay. So it's just a plan, not the
process. What part of your examples do you want to see in our design?
Okay. So I gave you sort of increasingly terse examples. So here's actually Trek 2006. So this is a 20-page paper, right? I'm not actually expecting you to write a 20-page paper. This took 3 people a week. But in it, we told you what document collection we were using. You'll have to come with that, right? We told you where we got the topics from. You'll have to come with that. We told you where we got the relevance judgments from. And we told you what measure we used. You'll have to tell me what measure you're going with. Now, you might reasonably complain that we'd already done that, and so we knew the answer. But back in 2006, we put up the track guidelines. So you can just go through this. Here's an introduction. Okay, that'd be nice. Be nice if you said what it was you were doing. How to sign up. You don't really have to tell me that, right? You are going to sign up for your evaluation. What data was provided? Does this look familiar? The documents? What we later took to calling the topics, which at that time we were calling introduction requests, and the relevance judgments. And then what data to submit, you don't have to worry about that. And what evaluation measure there really is. So it's the same pattern. If you want to tell me, if there's a slide on this in the evaluation section that said, you got to tell me the documents, you got to tell me the topics, you got to tell me the relevance judgments, you got to tell me the evaluation measure, that's what's in the test function. So those are the four main ones. And then looking at these two examples will give you an idea how those actually play out in reality. I mean, these are things that have been done in the last year by people who just sort of follow that cookbook and say, okay, fine, I'll take this data, I'll make a system, I'll send you the results, and you can run the evaluation. So it doesn't have to say, we'll use this script to run that evaluation. It has to say, we'll measure precision at 10, or mean average precision, or whatever it is. Yep.
Can we change our mind later on
the
measures
that
we have?
Oh, absolutely. And we did. In fact, at the end of the first year, we discovered we were measuring the wrong things.
Okay.
And so we ran an entire second year evaluation with new relevance judgments because our measure caused us to get the wrong relevance judgments. So we spent another couple of $100,000 to go off and get the right relevance judgments. Okay.
$100,000?
A couple of $100,000. Of volunteer time for the lawyers. I mean, they're lawyers.
So.
Actually, it's really great fun because we got all these really good lawyer jokes. The lawyers know better lawyer jokes than anybody else. Other questions? You all happy with what's going on in batch evaluation? And so the thing to think about from a judgment standpoint is, you don't want to spend too much time generating relevance judgments, or you'll never do anything else interesting. So you remember that good evaluations have the four different things, right? They're affordable and explainable and insightful, and they're in order. And number one is affordable. If you can't afford it, what are you doing? Right? If you can't afford it, then among the things you can afford, what will give you the best insight? Among the things you can afford that will give you the best insight, which of them are repeatable? Don't worry too much about whether you're right. Worry about whether you have a plan that you think you could reasonably execute. Because then what I will expect you to do is to try to execute it and see what happens. It's a learning experience, remember? So if you don't have a plan, you'll have trouble learning from what goes wrong in your plan. Right? But I want you to have a plan, and I want you to try to execute the plan so that you can learn. Not, I mean, I don't care what the results are, nearly as much as I care. Now, I will tell you, if you're working on expertise, the evaluation resources you create will be used by the expertise project. And if you're working on paper cases, the evaluation resources you create will be the only evaluation resources in the world for this HR table function, and they will be used by people who are interested in building techniques for selection, see if you're willing to share them. that's no different than where everything comes from the first time, right? Somebody gets a call change, try to evaluate and see how well their system's working, and then other people try to repeat their experiments with better systems. That's not important. Okay? And one of the things you're going to learn is nobody in their right minds will do evaluation this way, but for operational purposes, because the cost of generating the relevance assessments that would give you the adequate insight is too high. But to see that trade-off, you can't see it in the homework. You have to actually try it and find out where you run into affordability and insight and trade-offs.
You say evaluation system using one task. So one query and what possible results or what results come out of it?
That wasn't what I meant.
Okay.
What I meant was, let's say that I have a system that could be used by teenagers to find State Department cables that were written by their father. Okay. And it could also be used to find causes of, reasons for the U.S. decisions during the Israeli-Arab conflict in 1973, in the time frame of this collection. So, you would, you do better to pick one of those and model that problem than to try to say, oh, well, here, let's do three of these and two of those and seven of these other things that we could have also seen how well people could find things they've seen before, which is another thing people want to do. Right? So pick one task. But don't pick just one topic, because if you pick just one topic, then you'll find out how well it does on, you know, finding my dad. Right? Whereas, you know, I want to know how well it does on finding dad. Okay? Other questions? Okay, so if there are other questions, stop me, but otherwise I've got one more thing to talk about. Lots of people have been asking how to get started on a project, right? Like, where do I get an IR system? And what do I do with it? Just tell me that part. I'll do the rest of it, right? And so I thought it might be useful to just sort of sketch that out. We talked in this class about how you do this conceptually, but we never talked about what piece of software you use, right? And so in the project, you're going to do this little piece of software. Right? So this is actually much simpler than it seems when you first come to it. On the web page, there's a list of 15 of these. Under information retrieval resources, links to sources of IR systems. Okay, so available text retrieval systems. URA, Lucene, INRI, Zotere, Cheshire Creek. Now, it says here, the three you are most likely to want to use are listed first, others are listed in alphabetical order for completeness. It's like IR, right? Best first. So, which one should you use? Right? So just take any one of those three things, and those systems will have documentation with them that tells you how to index your documents. Then you'll take the system, which you'll install on your computer in whatever way that particular system gets installed, and you got a bunch of documents which you'll stick in a directory, and there will be some mumbo-jumbo that you type that translates loosely as Go. Right? And it will print stuff on the screen for a long time. And then after a while, there will be an index. Now, what will the index be? The index will be a file. And it will be some in some directory. And with any luck, you will have told it what directory to put it in, and you'll have plenty of space in your hard drive. Roughly the amount of space the collection took in the first place. So the collection's on the hard drive, now the index is on the hard drive. Now you've got the system, and you've got the collection. Now, the system really has two parts. It has an indexing part and a respond to the query part. And in Lucene, these are actually two different Java quests, an indexer and a query, or a search. So, now we'll take the search part, and the search part has a go that has to be called the query. You'll give it the query, and it will give you back a ranked list, which you can print on the screen if you feel like. So, I actually built one of these for the State Department tables with Lucene in about 3 hours. All three of the projects that are doing class assigned projects have a starter kit where we just give you the code. You just install it, say go, and it indexes the stuff. And then you say go to the searcher, and it searches the stuff. And the searcher knows where the index is, takes your query, finds the things from the index, and prints a ranked list of retrieval results. So that's available as a starter kit for each one of the instructor design projects. If you picked another project, you're on your own. But there's a long list of tech systems you can use. Yes?
Just that it gives a ranked list,
you
can have a default algorithm.
So, yeah, inside it's got VO copy formulas just sitting there waiting for you. If that's your research question, if you want a better ranking formula, but probably you'd be better off to think about whether to use stemming or which fields to index. I mean, you know, gosh, the people that are doing the State Department stuff, they got like 420 fields, right? I mean, very complex XML structure. People that are doing the searching for a professor thing, well, I mean, we got lots of the professor's web pages, and we got the professor's courses, and all sorts of things about the professor. Which of them do you index? So yeah, you can go in and tweak the formula if you want, but that's probably the hard part. The easy part is to tweak what the formula is working on. And for that, there's all these settings. Okay? So, you see what's going on here. I mean, there's nothing that I haven't already told you, except that there's one box, it's got a go button, and it does that. All right? So getting first light should be really easy. I mean, you know, it should end in the same week it starts. To go from I got nothing in my hands to I've got something indexed. Now, I mean, you know, maybe you just index three State Department cables, you know, not the whole collection. Or, you know, one professor. I can index one professor and then I can find that professor again. You know, right? Well, but once you have that, well, then you can do, you know, 300,000.
My goal is to index my code harder to make that work.
What's that?
I was trying to make Lucene work.
Yeah, and it indexed your whole hard drive?
Yeah, but it took me more weekend.
Okay. Well, don't point it at your whole hard drive. The Go thing does want to be told what to index.
No, that was the small part, but making it work was the big part. I mean, because it only indexes text documents by default, so it did not go through other stuff.
Uh-huh.
But making it work to index was a big part. It took like 1.5 days to make it work. Sometimes it gives some errors.
Yeah. But it finishes the same week it starts, right? Isn't it? You're up and running.
Yeah. It finished in half an hour. Yeah.
No, but I mean, the same week you thought, hey, it'd be nice if I could get Lucene working, it worked. Okay, good. Other questions? So I'm not presuming that everybody can open up the Lucene manual and get it to work, but I'm presuming that every team have two or three people that can do that. One person, at least on every team. If there's not one person that can do that, you need to come see. Okay? Good. Thanks.
We were thinking more.